Until now, the world has never had a legally binding agreement to protect marine life in international waters. But a month ago, after being signed by 145 nations, the High Seas Biodiversity Treaty came into effect. Australia has signed but not yet ratified the treaty. We're not yet bound by its provisions. To talk treaty, its origins and impact, I'm joined by Rebecca Hubbard, Global Director of the High Seas Alliance, an international not-for-profit that's worked closely on the creation and implementation of the treaty. Rebecca, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you. Good evening.
Rebecca, what are the hopes for this treaty?
Oh, there are very high hopes for this treaty. Essentially, it is really giving most people who have worked on ocean conservation or governance internationally the hope that we can finally properly protect biodiversity in the high seas. So that's all of the area outside of national jurisdiction and covers about half of the planet. And as well, also really giving us the hope that the benefits that come from the resources that are extracted in the high seas are more equitably shared with all citizens around the world.
But who will make sure this happens? What's the enforcing authority here?
Well, the parties or the countries themselves become the enforcers. So essentially, countries, as it's an international treaty, countries ratify the treaty and then they are bound by its obligations. And essentially, there are a number of rules and objectives which they need to comply with. And then there is a special committee that's been established called the Implementation and Compliance Committee that will support, facilitate, and very positively encourage countries to implement the treaty. So it isn't punitively applied, but it definitely relies on the cooperation and of the multilateral system.
But it's such a huge change from the understanding that out there on the high seas you can just rip the shit out of the globe. This is a big, big change.
Yeah, it is huge. It is literally the biggest change to ocean governance that we've seen in decades. It's a once in a generation piece of legislation and commitment. But you know, it's a massive task. And even though it took 20 years to negotiate the agreement from, you know, its inception, there has been an enormous amount of political will built over that time. A lot of political leaders, a lot of governments, scientists, civil society, Indigenous people engaged in that development process. And with that, you know, ownership, even, you know, in Australia, for example, the Liberal government was in power for many of the years that the negotiations were done. And so they feel that it's part of their legacy, just as the current Labor government also does, because, you know, they've been in power since it's entered into force and since it was adopted. So there's been a lot of you know, collaboration and cooperation and common will built over such a long time. And I think, unfortunately, it's both a good thing and a bad thing, because we are now much more aware of both the incredible value of our ocean and what it supports in terms of economy, livelihoods, climate, and food. But also we're much more aware of how destroyed and devastated it really is and how little protection it has. Like 1% of the high seas is protected. And so with both of those sets of increasing knowledge and that path that people have taken together over many years, we hopefully are finally at the point where we are, on the precipice of actually taking action to protect it actively, which obviously will have rewards for all of us as well.
Are all the big powers signed up? China, Russia, the United States?
So China and the United States have both signed. China has ratified. Russia hasn't signed, but all of the other big, most of the other big maritime nations like Korea and Japan, big European countries, France, well, Germany and the UK are in the process of ratifying. A number of countries are in the process, like Australia. They've signed. So we've got 145 signatories, but 85 have ratified. So a number of them are in that kind of final stages of passing legislation, which is, you know, quite a task for a government. But I think we do have extremely broad buy-in, and also from big countries in all the different regions. So we have quite a bit of buy-in from African nations, from Asia, the Caribbean, the Pacific. So it is really, it is very global in its nature, and the parties that are embracing it and engaging with it.
Explain the difference between signing and ratifying, and where is Australia on that?
So the difference is that when a country signs a treaty, it basically says it intends to follow and comply with the obligations and objectives of the treaty. And usually from a political process, it isn't as arduous a task. So, you know, a cabinet, you might seek cabinet approval for signature. You don't necessarily need legislation. So that's why you get 145 countries signing. Those countries are, however, not legally bound by it. They're just expected to comply with it and to not undermine its objectives. Once a country ratifies it, the process is different in all countries, which is a bit complicated, but it can, and for countries like Australia, it requires stakeholder consultations, legislative reviews, drafting of a new bill. And then, of course, in Australia, we've now submitted the ratification bill to Parliament, and it will be discussed in March. So it takes longer, but once it's done, the country is then legally bound by the treaty, and so it really can't act in any ways to undermine it, which means that we can proactively, you know, seek to create marine protected areas in the high seas. And it means we will have to conduct screenings or environmental impact assessments of potentially damaging activities in the high seas.
Do you see any possibility that we won't ratify it, or are we just sort of rattling down the course and it's going to happen?
Yeah, look, I don't think that there is a possibility that we won't, because we have had support across the parliament from all parties, or the major parties and the Greens in the past. So I don't think that's an issue. I think really that it's the pace that we have been slow on. And the reason that is an issue is that the treaty needs to have its first conference of parties. So just like the climate, the UNFCCC or the Convention on Biological Diversity have a conference of parties meeting each year where they make decisions, the High Seas Treaty will have one of those, and it needs to have one within 1 year of entry into force. So by, you know, mid-January next year. And if a country hasn't ratified by then, they cannot have a vote at that COP, as they're called. And so really Australia does need to make sure that it does finish the process.
On ABC Radio National, I'm David Marr, and I'm talking with Rebecca Hubbard, Global Director of the High Seas Alliance, about the new treaty to protect marine life. Rebecca, explain to us, what is the High Seas Alliance?
The High Seas Alliance is a global alliance of 80 members, mostly non-government organisations and the IUCN. And we were created in 2011 with the specific aim of protecting biodiversity in the high seas. And essentially at that time, the concept of a high seas treaty was in development. So they were discussing the need for it. It was a very long UN process. And so our alliance, our members, we have many experts, lawyers, policy nerds, as I like to affectionately call them, who really know, ocean management, conservation and governance inside out. And we really have participated in that process of the development of the agreement, the negotiation of the text. So what needed to go in there that would mean that we could really make an impact and actually protect biodiversity. And so we did that until 2023, when the negotiations finally came to a head and the text was adopted. And since then, we've been working to support countries to ratify the treaty. So we provide a lot of technical expertise, but we also do a lot of coordination with civil society groups, other NGOs, connect experts and scientists, work with Indigenous people, and really try as hard as we can to communicate the importance, the incredible significance of this treaty to the broader public, because it is kind of, a fairly lateral concept for a lot of people. I think very few people ever see the high seas, let alone know much about them.
Don't we see the high seas when we stand on a cliff and look out towards the horizon?
I don't think we can even see them from there. I mean, it's 200 nautical miles.
Yeah.
It's really, it feels like it's a long way away. But the fascinating and amazing thing about the ocean is that as much as we draw lines on maps and say this is our national waters, the species that live in the ocean don't recognize those boundaries.
They pay no respect whatever.
No respect for our lines. And so their movement across those boundaries, and as of course the movement of pollutants or other content in the ocean, and then of course, the movement of currents and all of those things, what happens in the high seas absolutely directly affects what happens in our national and our coastal waters and what happens on land. Because if we didn't have a healthy high seas, all of the services that the ocean provides us, like that climate control, like producing oxygen and all of those
little things, like producing oxygen,
just little things like supplying half the oxygen we breathe, and storing something like a quarter of the carbon that we produce, that stuff, it wouldn't happen if we didn't have a healthy, active, thriving ocean. And that's why the High Seas Treaty is so important. Even if you don't even go to the beach, it's still really, really critical.
You were saying before that or suggesting that this is a treaty that is going to cover all the oceans of the world, but does it cover the Antarctic?
So this is really good clarification, and for those of us who live in Australia, I think we're a bit more familiar with the Antarctic. There are high seas in the Antarctic, so the Southern Ocean is the high seas, but we have a different governance system for the Antarctic and the Southern Ocean. It's the Commission for the Conservation of Antarctic Marine Living Resources, and that is made up of something like 26 countries and the EU, and they have a specific form of governance that's been in place for many years to manage specifically the Southern Ocean waters. So whilst the High Seas Treaty, it could apply to those waters, generally it's called CAMELAR, the Commission for the Conservation of Antarctic and Marine Living Resources. CAMELAR is generally, they are the decision makers and the governance system for that area. So, but it's a little bit complex, but
are they keeping krill safe?
That's definitely a big question. And that is one of the biggest threats in the Southern Ocean is krill fishing, because krill are under a lot of pressure from, the impacts of climate change, warming waters, acidification, et cetera, already, and then they are also being fished by a number of nations. Why? I don't know a lot about the detail of krill, but they are favoured for their use in those vitamin and supplement fish oil supplement products, which people seem to think will make them youthful forever. And they can also be used as a fish farm food as well. So it's really like, yeah, for salmon, exactly.
Strange the price we pay for salmon.
The price for salmon is too high. We should not be paying that environmental price for salmon.
Rebecca,
we certainly don't pay it economically.
What's the single greatest threat to the well-being of the oceans?
I think the biggest threat to the world's ocean is still fishing, but the problem is that there are many threats to the ocean. So it's not just fishing, it's also climate change, including the heating of the ocean. So the ocean has absorbed over 90% of the excess heat that we have created as a result of fossil fuel burning, which means that instead of only being about 1 degree warmer, our air, it would be over 35 degrees warmer if it weren't for the ocean absorbing that excess heat. So it is burning up. It's acidifying with the absorption of excessive CO2. There's, you know, pollution from plastics as well as chemicals and oil. There's threats from shipping, both noise, which is incredibly destructive for marine life. There is the threat of new activities like deep sea mining or marine geoengineering.
Rebecca, stop.
Yeah, exactly. So this is why we need the High Seas Treaty.
and why we've got the High Seas Treaty. Exactly. Rebecca, thanks for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thanks so much for having me.
I've been talking to Rebecca Hubbard, Global Director of High Seas Alliance, about the new High Seas Biodiversity Treaty that the Alliance had a hand in shaping and now helping countries to enforce. This is Late Night Live.